A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one, and it's a listener request in the great figures shaping modern Jewish thought, genre, but with a twist. The figure is Rabbi Mike Nazielski, known in certain circles by his rabbinic moniker Haramian. And here's the thing. His documentary record is almost non-existent. No Wikipedia page, no viral shurim, barely a social media presence. His significance is carried by people who know him, not by search engines. Daniel wants us to explore what that means.
This is exactly the kind of figure I love digging into, because the facts we do have are solid and genuinely notable. And then there's this complete void where you'd expect a public profile to be. It forces a question most people never ask. What does influence actually look like when nobody's measuring it in clicks?
Right. And the timing of Daniel's request is interesting. We're in an era where rabbis are expected to have podcasts, Substack newsletters, Instagram accounts, YouTube channels, the whole influencer apparatus. And here's someone who apparently decided to opt out of all of it, or never opted in, and still became significant enough that people want us to profile him. It's almost a challenge to our assumptions. We've internalized this idea that if you're not building a platform, you're not building anything. And then along comes a counterexample.
It makes me think of the difference between a lighthouse and a lamppost. The influencer model is a lighthouse. You build something tall and bright, and you hope ships see it from miles away. But what Nazielski seems to be doing is more like a lamppost. You stand on one street corner, and the people on that street corner know exactly where to find you when it's dark. It's a completely different theory of how light works.
That's a useful analogy. The lighthouse reaches more people, but at a distance. The lamppost illuminates a smaller radius, but everyone in that radius can actually see their own feet. They can walk safely. And if you're in crisis, if you're at Bondi Beach and something terrible has just happened, you don't need a lighthouse. You need a lamppost.
Let's start with what's verifiable. Born and raised in Darlinghurst, Sydney. Bachelor's from the University of Sydney, Jewish Civilization, Thought and Culture, plus Hebrew, plus Government and International Relations. That's a triple concentration that tells you something about his intellectual range right from the start. I mean, most undergraduates pick one lane and stay in it. He's already weaving together textual tradition, language competency, and political theory before he's 22.
And those three disciplines don't just coexist on a transcript. They actually inform each other in rabbinic work. If you're going to serve diaspora Jewish communities, you need to understand how Jewish civilization operates within a broader political context. You need to know how minority communities negotiate with state power. That government and international relations piece isn't a random elective. It's practical training for a borderless rabbinate.
Then further study at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the Pardes Institute. And Pardes is worth pausing on, because it's not a seminary, it's a co-ed non-denominational bait, midrash. You sit with people from across the spectrum. Your Shevruta partner might be modern Orthodox, might be conservative, might be unaffiliated. That environment shapes a certain kind of rabbi, one who's learned to translate across difference from day one.
And then the historical first, which is a continent-level distinction. In June 2020, Plus61J Media reported that he became the first Australian ever to receive rabbinic ordination from Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, the flagship institution of open orthodoxy in New York. Semika class of 2020. That's not a footnote. That's an entire continent's first YCT Musmak.
And his stated vision from his YCT profile is worth reading closely. He wanted to engage, quote, in an authentically religious yet approachable manner with Jews who have limited textual background and religious experience and who are in need of support for increasing their knowledge. That is the Open Orthodoxy Project in one sentence. Non-judgmental, empathetic, meeting Jews where they are regardless of affiliation or background.
What strikes me about that formulation is the phrase, authentically religious, yet approachable. Those two things are often treated as being in tension. As if being authentically religious means being stern or distant, and being approachable means watering things down. He's rejecting that binary entirely. He's saying, no, the authenticity is in the approachability. The Torah is meant to be accessed.
And Jews who have limited textual background and religious experience. That's most Jews. That's the overwhelming majority of the Jewish world. So he's not carving out a niche for the already observant. He's orienting his entire rabbinate toward the people who might walk into a synagogue and not know what page we're on.
So we have the skeleton of a biography. But the skeleton tells us almost nothing about the kind of rabbi he actually is. Let's look at the shape of his career, because the geography tells a story.
The geography is hard to pin down, and I think that's by design, not by accident. Sydney to Jerusalem, that's Pardes, that's Hebrew University, then New York for YCT. Then, according to a 2022 social media post described as living in Canada. And yet he keeps showing up back in Australia at significant moments. This isn't aimlessness. It's a deliberate model of rabbinic work that refuses to be anchored to one community.
A peripatetic rabbinate, which has deep historical precedent, by the way. The traveling rabbi who serves multiple communities is a much older model than the single pulpit career path. The Magadim of Eastern Europe, the circuit rabbis of the American frontier. These were people who went where they were needed, not where they were stationed. But in the 21st century, it reads as unusual, almost mysterious. We're so used to the idea that a rabbi belongs to a specific synagogue, and that synagogue is their address. What does it mean when a rabbi's address is just the Jewish people?
And look at the roles. He served at Congregation or Chadash. He led learning at Mem Global's Shavuot Unveiled Retreat outside Sydney in May 2024, drawing participants from across Australia and New Zealand. These are not flagship pulpits. These are community touchpoint roles, the kind of positions where you show up, you teach, you build relationships, and then you move on.
It's almost the anti-platform model. Instead of building an audience that follows you, you go to where the audience already is, serve them, and leave them stronger. The question is, does that scale? Can you have a lasting impact if you're always moving?
I think that's the wrong question. The assumption baked into, does it scale, is that scale is the goal. But what if depth is the goal? What if the point is not to touch 1,000 people lightly, but to touch 50 people profoundly, in a way that changes how they live Jewishly? You can't measure that with a dashboard. But those 50 people might each go on to lead communities, teach others, raise Jewish families. The impact radiates outward in ways that are invisible to the person who originally made the investment.
So we're back to the lamppost. You don't know how many people found their way home because you stood on that corner. You just stand there.
And then there's the moment that I think defines this rabbinate more than any institutional role could. The Bondi Beach attack. He happened to be in Australia. And I want to be careful here. This is not about speculation or narrative building. He was present and he provided rabbinic services and pastoral support to people caught up in the atrocity. That's it. That's the whole story. And that's the point.
Present quietly when it mattered. If you wanted a single phrase to capture what this kind of rabbinate looks like, that's it. No press release, no op-ed afterward, no photo of himself at the scene, just showing up.
And let's think about what showing up actually requires in that context. It requires that someone knew to call him, which means he had relationships in that community. It requires that he was geographically reachable, that he wasn't on another continent when the crisis hit. And it requires a certain kind of personal constitution. Crisis pastoral care is not something every rabbi is equipped to do. You're dealing with trauma, with grief, with people in shock. The fact that he was the person they called, and that he came, tells you something about how he's perceived by the people who know him.
I think that moment also tells us something about the borderless career pattern. He's hard to locate precisely because he's mobile. And that mobility means he ends up being in the right place at the right time more often than someone anchored to a single congregation. If you're always in one city, your radius of impact is that city. If you move between continents, your radius expands. The trade-off is that you're harder to find. But when you are found, it's often precisely when you're needed.
There's one more piece of the public record that's worth examining, and it comes from an unexpected direction. Shimshon Leshinsky, the world-famous Jerusalem-based kosher food influencer, originally from Australia, has publicly called him a great guy from Sydney. That's one of the very few public validations of his reputation that exists.
And this is fascinating to me. Leshinsky has a massive digital footprint, millions of followers, constant content, a brand built on visibility, and he vouches for someone with almost no footprint at all. It's like the digital world's biggest extrovert pointing at a ghost and saying, "No, this guy is the real thing, trust me."
It's an endorsement that works precisely because it comes from someone whose credibility is earned in public. Leshinsky's audience knows him, trusts his judgment, and he's essentially saying, there's someone you can't find online who matters more than most of the people you can.
There's a principle in information theory here. The value of a signal depends on the credibility of its source. If someone with no reputation vouches for Nasielski, it's noise. If Leshinsky, who has everything to lose by associating his brand with the wrong people, vouches for him, that's a strong signal. He's spending his own reputational capital to boost someone who can't be verified through normal channels.
The personal details we have are thin, running, travel, music, but even those tell you something. What kind of rabbi lists running as a defining interest? One who understands embodied, non-textual spirituality. One who knows that some of the best pastoral conversations happen on a long run, not in an office.
A rabbi who runs is a rabbi who understands that the body and the soul are not separate departments. I'll give him that. Though as a sloth, I find the whole concept exhausting.
You find getting out of a chair exhausting.
Unfair. I find the chair itself exhausting. The chair is a commitment. It expects things from you. Sitting is a negotiation.
I don't know how you function.
Slowly. With great deliberation. Which, by the way, is also a valid model of rabbinic leadership. But we're talking about a runner, so let's stay on topic.
All of that, the borderless career, the quiet presence, the thin digital trail, it all circles back to one central mystery. And that mystery has a name, Harumian.
Here's where it gets fun. Harumian appears nowhere in print or online. It survives purely in oral tradition. Nobody, and I mean nobody, has ever been able to establish how or why he received it.
But it clearly follows the classical rabbinic acronym pattern, Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, Ramshe Eil ben Nachman, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lusato. So Haramayan plausibly unpacks as Harav Mike or Michael, then something beginning with Y, then Nasielski.
And that yud is the problem. Hey Rav Michael Y. Nasielski. What is the why?
Let me propose some theories, and I want to be clear. These are all speculation. Theory A, the Yud stands for Yerushalmi. Maybe a nod to his time in Jerusalem, maybe a name he picked up at Pardes. It would fit the pattern, a geographical marker embedded in the acronym, which has some precedent in rabbinic naming.
Plausible. But Yerushalmi is usually a surname, not a middle initial embedded in an acronym. If someone called him Harav Michael Yerushalmi Nasielski, that's a mouthful even before you compress it, and the rhythm is wrong. Harumian has four syllables with the stress on the last. Harav Michael Yerushalmi Nasielski has about 17 syllables. You'd lose something in the compression.
Fair. Theory B. It's a patronymic. Ben Yosef, Ben Yaakov, something like that, and it got compressed into the acronym. This happens. Rambam is Ben Maimon, not Maimon as a surname. So Harav Michael Ben Y, something Nasielski could compress to Haramian.
I like this one better. It has the right feel, the acronym capturing the lineage, not just the name. It places him in a chain, which is what rabbinic ordination is supposed to do. But we don't know his father's name, so it's unverifiable. And even if we did know his father's name, we'd need it to start with Yud, which narrows the possibilities considerably.
Theory C, it's not an acronym at all. It's a playful Aramaic-ized nickname that just happens to look like one. Ramyan could be a made-up word that sounded right, and the ha was added to make it sound like a classical rabbinic moniker.
This is the theory I'd bet on if I were betting, which I'm not, because I'm a sloth and gambling requires energy. But here's why. The best rabbinic nicknames often start as jokes, and then acquire gravity over time. Nobody called the Rambame Rambame in kindergarten. These things accrete. Someone makes a clever remark in the beat midrash, someone else laughs, it gets repeated, and 5 years later, it's how everyone refers to the person. The origin gets forgotten because the name becomes more real than the person's actual name.
Theory D. The Yud is a grammatical flourish. In Pseudo-Aramaic construction, you might get Harav Mike the Nasielski, and the Yud is a possessive or relational particle. It's a stretch linguistically, but not impossible.
I think we're overcomplicating this one. The Yud as grammatical particle would be unusual in this context, but I'll allow it as a dark horse candidate.
And then there's the Michael Nash detail, which complicates everything. Institutional records suggest he at one point went by Michael Nash. Why? Was it a professional name? A byline? A simplification for environments where Nasielski was hard to spell?
Or does Nash connect to the moniker somehow? Harav. Michael Nash. Harav me Nash. No, that doesn't work. But it adds another layer of elusiveness. This is someone who, at various points, used different names. Not in a deceptive way. More like someone who travels light and doesn't get attached to a single identifier.
It reminds me of the phenomenon of stage names, but inverted. Usually, people adopt a simpler name to become more visible. Here, the name change seems to have made him harder to track, not easier. It's like leaving a false trail in the archival record, probably unintentionally, but the effect is the same.
Which, by the way, is very much in the tradition of how great rabbinic monikers accrue. The Rambam wasn't called the Rambam by his kindergarten classmates. Monikers are bestowed by communities, not chosen by individuals. The fact that we can't trace Haramian's origin is itself evidence that it's authentic. It emerged organically, in conversation, in community. If someone had deliberately crafted it and announced it with a press release, we'd know exactly where it came from, and it would feel completely different.
And here's the second-order question I find compelling. What does it mean for a 21st century rabbi to have a moniker that exists only in oral tradition? In an age where everything is documented, where every sermon is recorded, every drasha is uploaded, every conversation leaves a digital trace, the fact that this isn't documented is itself a statement.
It suggests a community that values word of mouth over search engine optimization. A community where you learn about a rabbi because someone tells you about him, not because his content found you through an algorithm.
And that's almost subversive now. We've reached a point where not having a digital footprint is a kind of statement, whether intended or not. It says, my work is in person, my relationships are in person. If you want to know about me, ask someone who knows me.
The moniker itself is a gift from that community. You don't give yourself a name like Haramyan. You receive it. And the fact that we can't decode it, that the Yud remains unexplained, is almost the point. It's not for us to decode. It's for the people who use it.
I think we have to concede, in proper scholarly fashion, that the origin remains unknown. We've proposed theories, we've debated them, and we don't know, which is itself very much in the tradition of how these things work.
And I find that satisfying, actually. There's something refreshing about a mystery that resists resolution. Most things in modern life are overexplained. You buy a product, and there's a QR code that links to a 17-page origin story. Here's a name that means something to the people who use it, and the rest of us just have to sit with the uncertainty.
So we've sat in the mystery, we've proposed theories, and we've conceded we don't know. But that uncertainty is itself instructive. Here's what we can take away from a figure who refuses to be pinned down.
First actionable insight. Influence is not the same as visibility. Rabbi Nasielski's career is a case study in building significance through presence, not platform. For listeners who feel pressure to build a personal brand, the podcast, the newsletter, the speaking reel, his example is a counterweight. You can matter by showing up, consistently, quietly, in real rooms with real people.
And I think that's especially important in rabbinic work, which is fundamentally relational. You can't pastor someone through an algorithm. The Bondi moment. That only happens if you're physically present, if you're known in the community, if people trust you enough to call you when everything falls apart. None of that is scalable.
Let me push on that a little. Because someone listening might say, okay, but the Bondi moment is an extreme case. Most rabbinic work isn't crisis response. Most of it is teaching, counseling, life cycle events, community building. Can't some of that be done through a platform? Isn't there a middle ground where you maintain a modest online presence without becoming a full influencer?
That's a fair push. And I don't think Nasielski's model is a prescription for everyone. There are rabbis doing extraordinary work through podcasts and online teaching, reaching people who would never walk into a synagogue. The point isn't that platform is bad. The point is that platform is not the only path to significance. And for some people, opting out of the platform race might actually free them to do deeper work in smaller circles.
So it's not anti-platform. It's pro-optionality. You can choose the lighthouse or the lamppost, and both are legitimate. The danger is when the lamppost model gets erased from our imagination, when we start believing that if you're not building an audience, you're not building anything.
Second insight, oral tradition is not dead. It's just harder to study. In a world of digital exhaust, the things that aren't recorded may be the most interesting. We found out about Haramian because someone told someone who told Daniel. That's how knowledge used to work. And it still works that way in communities that prioritize relationships over broadcasts.
This is something listeners can actually practice. Pay attention to what doesn't get Googled. The best teacher you ever had. The most impactful community leader you've known. How much of their significance is documented? Probably very little. The things that matter most often leave the smallest digital trace.
I had a history professor in college who transformed how I think about evidence. And I just tried to Google him. He has a faculty page with his office hours and a list of publications. That's it. Nothing about the way he taught, the questions he asked, the way he made a lecture hall of 200 people feel like a seminar. The most important things about him are completely invisible to anyone who wasn't in the room.
That's the oral tradition right there. It's not that it's lost. It's that it's carried by the people who experienced it. And when they talk about it, they're doing exactly what Daniel did when he sent us this request. They're saying, here's someone you should know about. Let me tell you why.
Third insight, the moniker mystery teaches us that community naming is a form of authority. If you want to understand a community, look at what they call their leaders and why. Haramian tells us something about how his community sees him, as someone worthy of a classical rabbinic acronym, someone whose name carries weight. We don't know exactly what the name means, but we know it means something.
And here's a genuine research invitation. We're not being coy, we actually don't know. If anyone in the audience knows the origin of Haramian, or has a theory about the Yud that we haven't considered, we want to hear it. Email the show@myweirdprompts.com. This is a real mystery, and we'd love to solve it.
Or not solve it. I'm honestly happy either way. Some mysteries are better left as mysteries.
Which brings us to the open question. Will Rabbi Nasielski ever become a more documented figure? Will he eventually have the Wikipedia page, the published writings, the recorded shiurim, or is his significance inherently tied to its elusiveness?
I suspect the latter. The moment he becomes well-documented, something changes about the nature of his influence. Part of what makes him significant is precisely that you can't Google him. You have to ask someone.
There's a paradox here that I think is worth naming explicitly. We're doing an episode about him. We're creating a digital record right now. By talking about him, we're changing the very thing that makes him interesting, his absence from the record. Are we part of the problem?
That's uncomfortably meta. But I think there's a difference between documenting someone and turning them into content. We're not interviewing him. We're not trying to extract his story and package it. We're reflecting on what his elusiveness means. The elusiveness itself is the subject.
So we're documenting the absence, not filling it. I can live with that.
And as Open Orthodoxy matures and YCT graduates spread globally, figures like Nasielski, borderless, low-profile, community-focused, may become the norm, not the exception. The influencer rabbi model is one path. The quiet presence model is another, and I think we need both.
The best rabbis, like the best teachers, often leave the smallest digital footprints. They're too busy showing up.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1897, a British Orientalist confidently attributed a set of Tang Dynasty bureaucratic manuals to the wrong 7th century official. The error stood for 31 years until a Russian ethnographer working on the Yamal Peninsula noticed the manuals referenced a provincial administrative reform that didn't exist until 40 years after the supposed author's death.
That's a 31-year correction lag. Respectable.
The Yamal Peninsula is not where you go to fact-check Chang Dynasty bureaucracy. That's dedication.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone about it. Preferably in person. Leave no digital trace. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.